Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zier.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And it was your birthday this weekend, Daisy. How does it feel to be 1 year older?
Feels good. I think 34 is sort of like a non-year. It's not a big milestone, but I'm going to try to embrace it.
It's like you're midway between not midlife and midlife.
Well, you don't have to say that.
It's too late. We should say we are recording this intro after we spoke to the person, which is a little different than usual. But who did we speak to this week?
We spoke to Charlie Baker, who is the editor of The Fence, which is the UK's only magazine. Or they claim
pretty
to
great.
Be. This is a joke that I've made.
Tagline.
Actually rips off the same dirt and often. Ripped off the same joke and often tell people Dirt is the last digital media company in America. So I actually appreciate the grandiosity of this facetious statement. And Charlie had a lot of really interesting things to say about the history of London, the media landscape in the UK, and, you know, learning more about their audience. And they do also have a significant international audience that includes Francis and I.
Yes.
It's really nice to feel connected with something outside of the New York media bubble, and we need more projects like this.
So something I want to point out is by coming on this podcast, Charlie, perhaps not directly, but The Fence made £65 because I paid for a year subscription, which is the international fee. And I bring this up because earlier this morning I was doing some outreach trying to secure new guests for my other podcast, the Career Spotlight podcast. And
another podcast?
I do have another podcast. I've interviewed 60 people or so in the last year and something around that, maybe a little less. Anyways, I've reached out to plenty more than that, like probably 100 some. And nobody has ever asked if I pay a fee. And this time it was like a PR agent or somebody who was the contact I could find, and I reached out. This person has like 900,000 followers across all the social media, so whatever. But I sent my nice, long, thoughtful, like, hey, here's what I'd want to talk about, et cetera. And the reply was just, would there be a fee for this person's time? And I was shocked. This is the first time this has happened. But I bring it up because we did, in a way, I did pay Charlie a fee for his time. By subscribing to
Congratulations, Charlie. Don't spend
shocked.
It all in one place.
I was shocked. This has never happened to me before, that somebody has asked to pay, for me to pay for the guest time.
I think this goes back to our ongoing discussion about media literacy and the changing landscape. And I mean, we love to talk about what the difference between a journalist and a creator is, or like a thought leader. There are certain scenarios where I would be expected to be paid for my time, such as an honorarium. But even in certain scenarios that fall under that umbrella, so like a conference appearance, a panel appearance, or visiting a class, I've never really made that assumption. And it more has to do with like what I think the historical precedent is for imparting knowledge to a certain audience rather than like what I personally think my time is worth. I would always talk to somebody younger or in an educational environment for free if payment's not on the table. If it's a B2B context, if I know that the conference itself is ticketed, then I would expect to be paid or want to be paid. And then with podcasts, like that is creators who create media for the internet and are paid for it. As influencers have sort of like troubled the history of what it means to make a media appearance as a journalist or as an expert. And in the past, if you're appearing in the media, you're doing it for free because it's an extension of promoting your work, which is the journalism. But if you're a creator, your work is your appearance.
Well, what's interesting too, this person is kind of a creator journalist. I guess the case here though is maybe she's quite busy, this person. And again, it was a PR agent who sent me this reply. So I get respecting your client's time and like trying to make money for them. And obviously you're going to ask, I guess. They have a bigger audience. than Creator Spotlight. So there's that. So maybe it's like, well, this is an unequal value exchange. And they wouldn't have asked if I was some, you know, quite large podcast. But anyways,
I don't think it matters.
I respect the grift, I suppose, though I was a little offended as well.
I don't know. I think that, like, I don't know that that mindset in the long term is the correct mindset for somebody who's trying to make their way in media. You know, if you're an influencer and your product is yourself, feel free to charge whatever you want. But if you want people to value your ideas, then you need to understand there's a framework for appearing to promote your ideas within the current media ecosystem that should not be framed as an exchange of value. As soon as you frame it as an exchange of value, then you're going to end up on the other side of it.
Yeah. I think we should just go to this week's episode.
Good chat.
Good chat. All right. Talk to Charlie. Charlie, I do want to thank you because I did subscribe to The Fence. I'd been meaning to do it for a while, honestly. But then I had to do it.
Did you subscribe in print as well? I did subscribe in print as well,
though I made the mistake first of selecting the UK subscription, which is about half the price. I think it's about £35. And then I was like, that's strange. There's no way they're going to ship me all that stuff at that low price. And, you know, excellent customer service. You emailed me directly to rectify the problem, refunded me. I selected the proper subscription. So I just wanted to commend you on the record for your fantastic customer service.
Well, it is that's like the one aspect of it I really care about. And I think is an advantage of doing something in print is you're able to see what you've been making in the kitchen go out to the world. And, you know, I still manage that most of that aspect of distribution myself. Mm-hmm. At least saying what's going where, as opposed to individually packing them. And yeah, no, I'm very happy to do that, because I remember when, you know, the only people who subscribed were my friends. Yeah. They're watching its growth is a real
your friends real, and Graydon Carter
mm. and Graydon Carter, yeah,
early yeah, supporter.
Yeah. He was an early supporter. Yeah,
have you read his memoir yet?
When did it
no.
out? Well, it's not out yet, but oh. I assume no. it's circulating.
Have you read it?
No, I need to get an arc.
Okay, well, let's talk about The Office. How many issues into the magazine, into publishing the magazine, did you get The Office?
We got The Office in issue, it was in the summer of 2021 after we'd finished issue 8. Mm-hmm. So we've been here for 4 years now, and The Office is above a very famous landmark in London called the Windmill Theatre, which is the oldest strip club in the United Kingdom. And it has been open since before World War II. And there's a joke that we know it was open throughout World War II, throughout the Blitz, and that they never closed and that they were never clothed. and back when Britain was a deeply conservative, you know, country, and they got round the ban on nudity by not moving, by doing an act of, by being frozen tableau, you know, sort of as if they're acting on stage.
By not windmilling, as they did before.
By not windmilling. Yeah. And the story of this was made into a film starring Judi Dench called Miss Henderson Presents. But the Windmill is currently the site of dispute, because the freehold, the people who own the freehold are trying to lease it to Spin and Rhino, which I believe are an American strip club.
Is this something you guys have been covering in The Fence? This sounds like a really important dispute.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a big story. I mean, it's also just below us. So
right.
It's quite hard to avoid when you're coming in the morning.
You truly have boots on the ground.
Yeah, but it's got these very famous neon signs outside, and everyone sort of knows where it is. And we're on the street called Archer Street, which was in the 30s and 40s. It's on the back of all the we're on the back of all the West End theatres, where musicians would come and try and get work. And there's a couple of really fascinating documentaries about it. And it's where the first jazz club that was in Britain. And today it's got a really terrible chain bar called Be At One, which is directly opposite us. Quite generic restaurant. And it's got this new place called Spud Express, which is a TikTok craze where they're selling baked potatoes.
Is this the one where it's like the guy is filming from the trailer and people come up and I've seen these. There's like a line of like 50 people every morning. He gives the first person and the last person a free one, but it's just a baked potato with beans and cheese.
Yes, that's exactly. Thank you. I'm so
beans and cheese, nothing else.
It's a little butter, perhaps.
It's a baked potato, and so it's sort of, we've got this, we're on the street, just got this, you know, fascinating history, but not a particularly not particularly cool, but certainly a fascinating present
reality. Perfect place for you guys to be. Is the rent really cheap? Doesn't seem like an indie rag would have an office.
I'm going to put down $10 before you continue speaking that Charlie's not actually paying for this office space.
I'll tell you. So it was owned, made into another, this is a story of another film. So the freehold is owned by Soho Estates, which was started by a guy called Paul Raymond, who worked at the Windmill and then set up a number of magazines, basically the UK versions of Penthouse.
Lads Mags.
And Lads Mags, mm-hmm. Jazz Mags, Porn Mags. And his empire boomed in the 1970s. He became something of a celebrity. And what our offices are in the old offices of his empire. And so, because he made so much money in the 1970s, he also bought a lot of property in Soho. I think his estate now has a third of the property in Soho. I mean, the estate is worth in the billions. And Soho Estates, who own the freehold, have given, whilst the free floors are given to creative businesses to maintain Soho's artistic character. So on this next door office, we've got this guy, sports agency called Haters. There's a Raven Smith, who's
the writer.
The writer.
Haters, yeah, too. I feel like I've seen, I get the reels of like interviewing Mikel Arteta and such on my Instagram.
Exactly, yeah. Raven, who's, you know, is an industry. He's also on this floor, and then up on the floors above, there's some people from like tailors and shirt makers and sculptors. It's a nice little mix. Yeah, we are paying rent, but not much.
That's awesome.
Thank you for doing your part to preserve the culture of Soho. It's so important.
Yeah. Thank you, Soho Estates.
Well, okay. The real reason we're here is that you launched a new newsletter called The Capital Letter. Speaking of the culture of Soho, this is, you know, about
London,
the city, real time information of what people should be doing, seeing. Tell us how this came about. Is this based on like content that you saw was particularly popular, resonating? Is there a hole in the media market right now for something like this?
Yeah. So I found, having done The Fence for 5 years, that I got to know London with an intimacy that I hadn't before. Partly by having to be here the whole time because of my job, and partly getting to know lots of people who know London really well and much better than I did. And then also, having not particularly liked living in London for large periods of my life, I've really started to love it in the last 5 years. So I felt that from a personal perspective, I could do something which I wanted to be kind of more, I guess, I wanted to marry something that was functional with something that was also, dare I say, lyrical without trying too hard. And that, I felt, was the space that was open for us. But the functionality, I think, is really important. There's this amazing book called Alternative London, which is by this guy called Nicholas Saunders, who Jonathan Nunn wrote this amazing long read about The Guardian. And Alternative London is this guide in the 1970s, which just lists all the things that you can do in London on the fly, the absolute best places to buy antiques, the best places to buy cheap wine, how to get furniture for free. And what I thought was quite interesting was, in this kind of digital age where information is technically supposed to be free, people are much more zealous about gatekeeping their absolute best tips. And I've seen this a lot with people who run restaurants, especially, where I know the tips they're giving aren't their top tips.
You mean like the people who are being interviewed by Top Jaw or whatever?
Yeah.
Vittles better not be holding back on me. I live vicariously through that newsletter.
Jonathan puts his favorite places in, absolutely. I wanted to do like something that was really functional and really honest, and we're pulling up the drawbridge, we're not keeping the gates, is kind of so that was the first thing I wanted to do. I'll give you a more concrete example. Like there's this place in Tooting, which is a really unglamorous bit of South London, which is where all the major fashion designers in London go to buy Italian vintage from the 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties. My fiance is a fashion designer. That's where her and her friends from when they're at CSM went. That's where they still go today. But you don't really see that many stories about it. It's something that people really do gatekeep. Mm-hmm. So it's things that, you know,
is Harriet going to be upset if you blow this wide open?
I don't think she minds.
She's bought enough stuff there already over the years.
She's bought enough stuff there. She gets enough free clothes from work. I think she's happy. So there was that aspect to it. And then what I think is really interesting about, you know, London is if you go into Waterstones, which is the big Waterstones here around the corner, which is the biggest bookshop in Europe, and it's got the whole floor dedicated to London, like a quarter of it is about, you know, present day London, and the rest of it is dedicated to the history of London. So there seemed to be a really wide open space for people to write about, you know, London and its history in a way that you can interact with it. So we just felt that there were lots of things that people weren't doing, and then that we had a few advantages in terms of our coverage of pubs, our food and drink coverage, and our arts coverage is already really good, and it'd also be a fun way of, the theatre coverage is definitely something that's in our wheelhouse, and something. I used to go to the theatre all the time, but I haven't been like 5 years, a way of sort of reacquainting yourself with the city. There were loads of things where we kind of felt is that nice balance of something that was, we felt the audience is going to really like, and something that we're going to like doing as well.
Who is the audience? So, I mean, I asked that too, as in I've been aware of you guys for a little while, certainly not for your whole lifetime. Yeah. I just subscribed. I'm part of the audience internationally now. Is it like, how much of the audience is, would you say, if you know, is in London versus the UK more broadly versus international?
I would say of our existing audience, I think about 40% is in London. Probably 45% is in the rest of the UK, 5% is in Europe and the rest of the world, and then 10% is in the States. But yeah, I just, weirdly, this is a exact conversation with Jonathan Nunn, because he said, we've got loads of American subscribers, but don't really do American coverage. I think that's
what Jonathan Phipps or
Jonathan Nunn at Vittle, mm-hmm. at Vittles. And I think, that's a great aspect of American culture, how people, they're interested in what's going on internationally. Mm-hmm. So what I want to do is create something that, with capital letter, that people who are coming to London for a period of time will want to read. Yeah. So it does have an international reach in that regard, but it also has to be, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I want it has to be something that's authentic and absolutely true to people who are proud about having lived in London for a long time. Mm-hmm. Zealous Londoners, you might say.
I wanted to say about the American relation to how Americans consume the UK and UK culture. Mm. I feel like I think I'm a part of this trend of I started watching the Premier League a couple years ago after the last World Cup. I was like, I want to watch soccer, football more regularly. Mm. And so I was like, okay, I'll pick a team that some of my friends like, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then I started drinking your Guinnesses, et cetera, blah, yeah. blah, blah. And now I'm getting
your Guinnesses. You're giving him a lot of credit.
It's the proverbial your, the royal your. but I feel like so much of my content I get on social media is British. You got your schooner scorer. These other freaks. I guess the point I'm trying to make is I don't know. Is it just that I started watching a lot of soccer and thus my cultural consumption started veering more UK? Or do you think there is more this fascination or current wave of US obsession with UK culture?
I think there's a cultural interchange, right? Where I grew up playing, football and cricket, and all my friends play football and cricket, and as in soccer and cricket, and now lots of my friends who are quite sports obsessed go to American football games. When they come to London, people watch the Super Bowl.
That's so bizarre to me. I see that with some of the footballers I follow, Harry Kane and stuff, who are obsessed with it. And it's so, why do they love the Patriots? That's so bizarre. But it's the same. Yeah. It's the cultural exchange. Yeah.
Yeah. I think American football has been, a big breakthrough. And I guess there's kind of there's Britpop in the 90s was kind of a reaction of the dominance of America culturally. I think now people are Britain's kind of in a prouder place culturally, not politically. I think that's it. If I can generalize about Britain is brat.
Francis is shaking his head. He did not like that joke.
Did you have a brat summer, Daisy?
I mean, we all did. We didn't have a choice, but it ended pretty quickly in November. we're very post-brat. We're living in a post-brat society, unfortunately, but.
Yes. Well, everyone apart from Charlie XCX is living in a post-brat society.
I saw this. I've been talking about reels I've seen on Instagram far too much on this podcast, as I always do. But I saw this reel recently of an American podcast. They were interviewing a British guy, and they were talking about how there's no dive bars in the UK. And you have The Fence is publishing a book on English pub culture this year, right?
Yeah. So that's one of our things. If I might be so arrogant, my friend Jimmy, who does our pub coverage, and he does London Dead Pubs, which has become very big on TikTok and on Instagram, and he's Schooner Scorer's sort of nemesis. So he does these.
Which one's the Wario? Which one's the Mario? Is he the Mario?
Jimmy does these he's sort of good looking and funny and a brilliant writer. And does these? He does these sort of Adam Curtis style short things about hidden London pubs that people really know about. He wrote some pieces for us, and I think 3 years ago, and there's been a noticeable uptick in pub coverage across the rest of the UK. I just think it was one of those things that people just didn't realize you could people have opinions about.
That it was just like a part of the furniture for so long.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's also, because clubbing, night clubbing in the UK, has that industry has really created with the cost of living, with increased trends in sobriety, and many more.
Yeah, what is the vibe in London right now? And like, what's the worst type of person?
Scooter score is fascinating as well, because he's pretending to be something he's not. He's
I've tried to find his real name. I wanted to find his LinkedIn. What does he do for a living?
He used to work in the oil industry. It's called Alex.
That makes complete sense. I knew finance is what I thought.
As we know from our conversation with the guys who wrote industry, it's much harder to pretend to be something that you're not in London than it is in New York. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen his videos where he's on safari in Africa.
Yeah.
He's in Australia. I am fascinated by him. I've watched far too many.
It's called Alex Hendy. Yeah, he's from North Lincolnshire, which is where I'm from, and he was running a business selling condiments just after he was just as he was out of high school. So he's kind of like his own creation. He's kind of like something from like a 19th century novel. Hmm. At least I hope he is. Maybe I'm making him sound more interesting than he is.
Were the condiments good?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think they're business creators, so.
Yeah.
Well, I've got an article on him in The Sun up.
Yeah.
And from what I can see, he's the owner of three businesses. As of June 21st, 2024, he assumed the position of director and chief executive at Schooner Social Limited. He is at the helm of his own social media and digital marketing enterprise. He is also the director and chief executive of AJ Strategic Investments Limited, and the position of director and associate at Olivia Court Residence Limited. So I'm understanding he's a landlord.
I think that is from when you all live in a somewhere together. Those tenant associations are usually on company's house.
Okay.
In the UK. So I imagine maybe he owns an apartment.
This is like the UK equivalent of people who just like collect LLCs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I feel like that culture is so different though in the UK. It's harder to do that,
It's not cool to be an entrepreneur, is it? Is it cool to be an entrepreneur in London, Charlie?
There's an answer to your question about like who's super, there is an entrepreneurial energy in the city at the moment. Which I think is you know, you see people hustling much more visibly in a way that you didn't 15, you know, even 5 years ago. Like with the
don't even bring your laptop home. I've tried to like email you after 5 p.m.
Is that true?
It is true.
I leave my laptop in the office. Yeah, I just don't like carrying it around like a turtle.
Is that a Conclave reference?
No. It's an animal reference.
Okay. Well, a turtle is carried around the Vatican in the Conclave film. So.
Oh, right.
I haven't seen it yet.
But yeah, there's like an entrepreneurial, there's an entrepreneurial vibe to the city. Like people, you've got people that are like doing the tuk-tuks. It feels kind of like
people regressive. Stealing phones. That's entrepreneurial.
People stealing. Well, it is entrepreneurial. You know, one of my colleagues had his car stolen this morning, and the police, he was from the police, speaking to Seamus, and the police at lunch said, sorry, we're not going to take any no further action. The case is closed.
The police are not very entrepreneurial, to be clear.
Sorry, Seamus. Was the inadvertent subject of a viral British television clip, right?
Oh, what the... The Irish.
Irish, well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a not particularly intelligent Irish rugby player called, but very sweet, called Tommy Bowe. who has pivoted into being a television host. And he was the main host was saying, we're going to speak to Seamus O'Reilly about his life with having 10 siblings. And Tommy Boy went, 10 siblings? And how they coped after their mother died. And it like cut Tommy's face. And obviously he's just like, oh my God. So ashen-faced. So,
I have seen that. Seamus, that is very good.
Yeah. You have seen that? That's Seamus. Yeah. You have to read his memoir. It's fantastic. And he's been writing some incredible columns. I think I linked to him maybe in the Irish Examiner and Dirt recently, but I absolutely loved the memoir. What was it? What's the memoir called?
Did You Hear Mammy Died?
Did You Hear Mammy Died? Because that was another, I guess spitting something out insensitive when you're like a small child is a little different than when you're like a professional broadcaster. But he was going up to people at his mom's funeral and saying, did you hear mommy died? Yeah.
I think a very small child.
Yeah.
I think he was six. I think he probably was.
Perhaps it's a little bow tie. It's just such an incredibly touching book. And he's a father now too. And he has some great tweets about fatherhood. And also I'm realizing now that Seamus has contributed like really a disproportionate amount, especially being from a small country, to internet virality, because he also is the author of a viral Twitter thread about being incredibly high at his job during the visit of, what was it, the Irish?
Yeah, but then the former Irish president, Mary McInnes.
President. Yes. And this recirculates annually.
Not only that, Seamus would talk about it has done very happily in public. I mean, that's kind of how he got his writing career. He was working in an office job.
Wow, I didn't realize that preceded that.
Yeah, and then he did this thread, and then he got asked to do a couple of jobs by some editors, and after, like, he kept on tweeting throughout that, and I think after 6 months he was able to have enough work come together, do that parenting column for The Observer, that he was able to, he was able to lead. He was doing, I don't know exactly what he was doing in his boring office job, but it wasn't something he wanted to be doing.
Kind of like that movie Zola, where they made a movie after the
Honestly, not that far off from the Zola situation. One thing I wanted to ask about, I mean, I try to ask something like this when we have another, publisher on, but like what's a quintessential like fence story, and what of the stories that you've published do you feel like most embodies the ethos of the magazine for people who haven't read it yet?
I think the sort of fence story is the one that John Phipps did in the summer of 2020. 5 years ago, where he interviewed a lot of people with terrible names like Adolf Hitler, Jeffrey Epstein, and Harvey Weinstein, what their life is like having that name. And he got a suite of really funny and largely quite moving responses. And I think it ends with somebody, with Jeffrey Epstein, not that one, responding to him, saying, sorry, John, I don't really understand what you're asking for here. Hadn't occurred to him that there was some duality in being also sharing the name with Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, that sounds great for him. I would love his brain.
That's definitely one of our pieces. And then, like, the one when we asked the Nobelists loads of silly questions, like asking the Nobel winner for chemistry in 2022, who the most beautiful woman he's ever seen is.
Prize for the most beautiful woman in the world.
Yeah.
And Well, piece that we syndicated, I think, was it Ella Fox Martin's piece about being a chic young divorcee, that was very popular with our audience. Yeah.
That was Roisin. Michael, who's...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. Apologies. Yeah, it's fine. You don't have to know. You can't know two publications intimately. One is enough. You've got your own one to remember the writers for. Roisin sees about being a divorcee. That was a fantastic piece for us. And you just knew it was going to... I'm sure you know that feeling when you publish something and you just know it's going to get a great reaction and a unilaterally great reaction as well. Do you sometimes publish stuff, Daisy, where you're worried that you're like, I think...
Ella wrote the piece Icarus Also Flew, which was another great piece about relationships for the fence. So I'm not so far off. But
No. I wasn't saying that you were. But they... I really love doing personal essays and just trying to make the prose really taut and, you know, each sentence, you know, not a word wasted.
Yeah.
So I think it's this sort of, it's a mode of writing, which obviously, as the name suggests, is indulgent. But
tell
also,
us about
I think,
you as an editor. Like, how do you approach that side of the work?
Well, I think the most important job with editing is commissioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
you've got to
make sure that you've got the right subject, that the person you've commissioned has got enough time, has got the resources, understands it well, isn't going to be, you know, doesn't feel like they're being compelled to do something. And then I think, as I'm sure you know, Daisy, it's like people have different processes where some people like texting you, updates, and that's part of what works for them.
Some people love texting me.
And some people, you know, just kind of like how a cat, you know, drops a mouse as a present, will just, you know, drop a 1500 word to perfect piece, which,
and it was supposed to be 800 words. Yeah.
No. It's just like a perfect... Some people just, you know, just drop back into your inbox like 2 months later with a perfect piece. So I think that's... Yeah, I try not to... With editing, I try not to be too... And I also try not to be too... You know, I want to do like 1-2 rounds of edits, really. Mm. I don't want to drag the process on or kind of make it into... a sort of a competition where we're trying to flex. I want the writer to score a goal and I want us to score a goal. And that's why the commissioning process is really important, because you need to make the writer remember that you're on the same team together and you've got the same goal.
Right. Like your filtering's happening sort of up front rather than, I feel the same way. And I also like, I've very rarely done more than 2 passes on a piece. Cause like at that point it's like, well, I'm bored. We're not going to improve this that much. Like it is somewhat binary where something either feels publishable by Dirt or not. And that's kind of already determined in the subject writer pairing.
You get that right before you started.
Right. Like, and if we're dropping into 5 passes, then something else has like gone terribly wrong.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. I also rather spike pieces and just pay people than because it's also everyone who works for me is working 1 or 2 days a week. So they were just in the office earlier. And so I want to be careful of their time as well. And it's quite demoralizing if you spend, you know, 2 hours making a piece, using all your skills to make a piece from like 6 out of 10 to 7.5 out of 10. And then, you know, it goes online and it doesn't really bang. Mm-hmm. So I think generally I try and be wary of the resources we have.
Are you spiking a couple every issue?
I'd probably spike about 10, 15 pieces a year.
A year. That's not bad.
How many do you publish a year?
Like 100, I'd say. Maybe like 90, 100. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I want to, it's important that the magazine feels like somewhere that a really good writer wants to have a byline in, which it does, but also feels like somewhere that somebody feels they could pitch to and they could get in the magazine. So sort of like maintaining that identity is really important to me. Because yeah, the flip side of you know, the commissioning being really important is it's also, you know, you've got to find a way of taking punts on people who aren't known quantities as well. I mean, I guess the difficult thing in the publishing industry, which lots of people don't really say out loud, is that, you know, throughout the whole industry, both in England and America, you know, people write loads of stuff and they don't always get paid for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we commission something, we always pay somebody for it, but that's not the truth across the board. It's hard in that way.
I think though, like starting a magazine is an act of optimism. And I feel the same way about Dirt and, you know, new sub brands that we've been launching and we have more coming. And it always feels like an act of optimism. But I'm curious if like you feel optimistic about the future right now, generally, and if you have cynicism, like how are you handling that through this platform that you have?
It's a very good question, Daisy.
Thank you so much. Actually, well, Francis wrote it down, but I asked
actually,
it.
Actually, I stole it from a previous interview you did 4 years ago.
Yeah, so I'm the assist. You're the assist. I'm the score. Go on, yeah. Charlie. Oh, sorry.
Too much football talk.
you're a great host together. It's natural rapport.
Thanks.
I feel like I'm happy that we've got an established brand, to use corporate speak. It's no secret that what we're doing is doing more newsletters, and that's going to be the way we expand, and that we keep the fence as kind of like the print flagship and expand digitally through doing different paid newsletters.
Is that where you're seeing the most revenue growth as well?
That is where we're seeing the most revenue.
Best margins, to be sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the margins.
We talk about that a lot on this podcast. Like, it's not a trick question. I think that's like, there's a strategy alignment there that's happening for a lot of people.
Well, and I think, the thing is, you know, the fence is £7.50 on the newsstands, right? And if the magazine's on the newsstands, you've got to be realistic, where if the New Yorker is £7.99, what's the average consumer going to choose, right? You know, you can't say, oh, it's an independent magazine. The consumer doesn't really care about that. So if you're doing something which is current affairs, general interest, like we are, you know, you can't price your product much higher than your peers. Whereas, and people also have a warped sense of value, consumers have a warped sense of value, because all the other print magazines can print hundreds of thousands of copies, have special subscriber deals, have all this advertising revenue, which isn't available to us.
And they're either so cheap or they're like $40.
Yeah, right. So I think the thing is with newsletters, people are like, okay, will it just cost £30 a year? Will it just cost £40 a year? Great, that's fine. They're like, well, this is how much it costs. Okay, I'll pay it. Yeah, for each issue is the costs of distribution are now our single biggest expenditure. So the price of success and all of that.
That's why I was so shocked when I bought the subscription. I was like, it's £35 and then ship it to the US? That can't be right.
I've done some international shipping recently and it's hard. But you don't want to cut people off. You want to have a truly global product.
Yeah.
But
are you trying to get to a point where you can hire another person full time? Because I believe it's just you full time, right?
It is just me full time. My colleague Kieran is working. Is going to be working a few more days, and doing a few more business things with me, which is good. Our plan for this year is to do this book about pubs, explore launching another newsletter after Capital Letter for next year. And we've signed with CAA, and we've got some exciting things happening in the world of audio.
The books model makes sense to me too, in that, like, that just makes me think this past weekend I was at Mast Books in the East Village, and they had like 10 different books by Apartmento there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we feel that we could do like a book every 2 years, mm-hmm. and we've made the book about pubs really quite good.
Who's the publisher?
Penguin, Ebury, mm-hmm. which is an old imprint of Penguin, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, to circle back on your original question, Daisy, I'm worried about the global situation, but I'm not particularly worried about the fence. What about you? Are you worried about?
No, I feel the same way. I feel like the way that I feel about the world is really a lot of concern and negativity, but I do feel empowered within this platform that I've built and carved out to continue to deliver things to people that are interesting, beautiful, enriching, relevant. You know, maybe you and I can do an abroad exchange where I'll come run dirt out of London for a month and you can come run out of the New York suburbs. Yeah. Well, my offer to you is a little bit less enticing because we don't have an office, but I think there's something here.
Yeah. How do you manage your employees that are just working from home?
I don't know. They're all afraid of me. No, I'm kidding. I think that people who work out like well, just it's a sort of a self-selection thing. Like their way of working aligns with my way of working asynchronously. And, you know, even if somebody comes in as an intern, if they're like really good at working that way with me and anticipating my needs, then I just keep them like Walden, you know, he started as an intern and now he's like a contributing editor because he and I were able to work that way. If somebody didn't like that way of working, I think, you know, we would have a good relationship, but they probably would stick around less. Mm. Yeah.
Do you have people working full time?
Nobody full time. No.
Yeah.
It's similar to you. It's challenging. It's a little, do you get lonely? It's a little lonely. I guess you're less lonely if you have an office.
Yeah, I do get lonely doing a lot of the admin. And then also, you know, there's just like, I mean, you have to do a lot of stuff that especially sort of, you know, meeting and greeting, which is quite hard work. And I think it's the role switching where you go from writing and editing, host, you know, managing and sort of, you know, listening to people's needs and then having to do, you know, a lot of administration. Also kind of having to sort of be charming and be funny.
See, I cut out the charming and funny part and it's saving me a lot of energy. So really? You should, you can start cutting corners there on your personality.
It was a lot of work, to be honest. Don't try. So I think I think it's hard in that regard.
I think it's like, there is the challenge of using different parts of your brain, but I think the other thing about it is actually, and Charlie, I feel like you're sort of like hinting at this, like, a lot of the pride comes from doing the admin part well, but you can't really talk about it to other people. There's not really any status in it. It's not something that you can really share or even like brag about. Like when I go through the finances and I can see, hey, we're going to make it through the next 6 months and I'm going to move this here and move this here, move this here.
Yeah.
Arguably feel more of a sense of pride than like when I edit an article. But if I try to like go to dinner and tell my friends like, oh, I made a spreadsheet today, it's really, it's not that exciting. And so then I push externalizing and sharing into other decisions. Like, hey, look at these three logo possibilities that just got sent. Like, what do you think? And I put like a lot of like emotional weight on that interaction because here's something that I can externalize and share and invite my friends to like make decisions about. And I think they're like, oh, okay, Daisy, you know, it feels disproportionate to what I want to share. And I think that that's where the loneliness comes from.
Yeah, exactly. I think in a lot of those, it's weird. I'm very confident at doing stuff that I didn't think I'd be good at 3 years ago, like managing and giving notes or editing notes to, you know, people who were like childhood icons of mine. Mm-hmm. But there's certain things that I still kind of feel like I'm 12 or 13 years old when I'm doing, you know, like when I find sort of, you know, hosting multiple people who aren't, you know, for events, I find that quite stressful. And yeah, I find that like, yeah, people don't really want to hear about your struggles when you've got a semi-successful startup. They want to hear about, you know, funny stories. And yeah, so you're right. There is a loneliness to it. And I think also, I think you can also self-martyr a bit by, you know, working too long and not having a division between work life, social life. And that's one thing I've really tried to get better at.
Oh, I am the biggest self-martyr. It is my hugest flaw. And
get down from the cross. We need that word.
I was about to reference the same tweet. I saw that tweet and I was like, damn, that's me. I'm feeling a lot of self-awareness at the moment. It's such a double-edged sword though, right? Because people still want you to do what you're doing for them. They just want you to be less of a martyr about it. And I'm like, can't have one without the other, baby.
Well, my parents do a good one with me when I go home intermittently and I'm like, sorry, I've got to work, or if it's a Sunday I go, like, I'm sorry, I've got to do some emails. My mum calls me President Zelensky. She's like, oh, President Zelensky, are you organizing replacement missiles, you know? I think it's a good one, because it's always good to kind of be reminded that what you're doing is in the grand scheme of things not that important. Obviously it couldn't be more important in the passage of your own life.
It's good to
be aware of how one can come across to other people.
Well, and you happen to be talking to two Americans that actually do think what Zelensky is doing is important. So I'll go on the record and say he has a very important job and deserves respect. Me, I deserve respect, but my job less important. Maybe we should end there.
We should end it there.
Yeah. I have to say, I really enjoyed that. I generally don't enjoy. I'm looking forward to these things ending. I was really having a good time there. Thank you so much. You guys have really cracked it.
Thank you for saying that. We're going to cut that and use that as a commercial.
We will use that. And anybody listening right now, why don't you go and subscribe to The Fence?